Hi everyone, welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm Langdon DeMint.
And I'm Julian Taylor.
And welcome to our podcast.
Hello and welcome to Two Bald Guys and a couple of fairly hairy guys who are here to talk about safety this week. So really pleased to be joined by a couple of guests today. First of all, let me just introduce my shiny-headed compadre from Nashville, Tennessee. Mr. Langdon DeMint. How are you, Langdon?
Hola, and that's shiny because it's greasy. I'm good. How are you?
Have you not shampooed it today?
Dude, why do we have to call each other out like that? You feel like you know, so this is a first. We don't usually say anything like that. I don't like to tell a story, so I'm just not going to answer.
Okay, cool. We're joined today by two special guests, Tim Marsh, Professor Tim Marsh, and Jason Anker, MBE. So when I say special, they are special guests. Guys, do you want to introduce yourselves? Maybe Tim, if you go first.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jules. My name is Tim Marsh, and my background in safety is that I ran the first... Oh, I've got a dog going crazy next to me. I ran the first behavioral safety project in Europe, 92 to 94, looking at behavioral safety on construction sites. From there, spent the next 10 years on an oil rig doing professional behavioral safety, safety leadership, safety culture, general culture. And over the last half dozen years or so, really worked with Jason on a kind of a much more holistic approach to human error, which incorporates well-being, mental health, physiology, and all that good stuff. So that's me.
Jason, I'll hand it across to you.
Okay, so I was involved in... totally avoidable workplace accident in 1993, which left me paralysed from the waist down in a wheelchair. I've been speaking now for 16 years. When I first started speaking, it was mainly working at height in the construction industry. And obviously, as my story sort of progressed over the years and joining with Tim, it's made me realise that my well-being played a quite significant part in me choosing to work unsafely.
What got you into speaking about safety? Obviously, you'd had your incident, but how did you end up then becoming this high-profile public speaker?
Quite bizarre, to be fair. I was drunk at a Christmas party, and a complete stranger just approached me and asked me why I was in a wheelchair. And we subsequently met up. His name was Dan Terry. Unfortunately, he's passed away now. But Dan was very much into behavioral safety type presentations. And he said, I don't really like playing a video. What I think I would do is have someone live in the room to give a live story of an accident. And back then it was very raw. Obviously, I've not spoke to anyone about it, probably not even myself. So when I first started, it was very raw. I was very angry. There was a lot of blame still in my presentation. You know, it took me a few years of me presenting to then to switch to realise what role I'd actually played. Yeah, I was let down. That day, I mean, pressure was putting us to get a job done, a rush job end of shift. I fell off a ladder, the ladder slipped. I knew it was unsafe, but for many years I blamed everybody else. You know, it was all about blaming, look what's happened to me, and don't be like me. Over subsequent years, I've made quite a lot. In fact, when people see me today, you saw me years ago, think I'm a different person, because he was very angry back then. And I was very angry. But over the years, I've mellowed, and obviously, even more so, linking up with Tim, made me realise, you know, why I did what I did, and it was a massive, massive like awakening, really, to understand that there was more to than, you know, for a lot of years it was all about speaking up. If I just get people to speak about safety, everything's going to be okay. And you know, speaking up for me is obviously very important, but it's where it normally sits. So just before you're going to do something unsafe, we want you to stop and to speak up. Now, as Tim will delve into a little bit more, there are many reasons, in fact, why people choose not to speak up. You know, embarrassment, not wanting to make a fuss. Mine was just, I was on a really bad day. I had a bad year, to be fair. So coming to work for me was a chore I didn't want to do. Didn't want to work in construction. It was forced on me due to recession. So I was turned up for work in a pretty poor state every day, you know, for months before it happened. And, you know, on that day, that I had slipped. I didn't get away with it. But I'm not, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say there's many situations in the months that led to my accident where I took shortcuts and took risks. But as we all know, nine times out of a thousand, you're going to get away with it. And, you know, I've always said, if my accident not have happened, you know, people often say to me, oh, give yourself some advice back then. I hate doing it. I said, look, there's no point in going back in time because I can't do that. I can only do what I do now. I know Jason in 1993, even if I spoke up, even if I was not done what I did, I would have still gone to the pub after work. I would still been late home. I was still, my marriage problems were still in there, the debt. You know, how long will it have been till that situation arose again and I've done the same thing? Where I know how I live today with my well-being, all the things I do, look at my mental health. Jason today would not have climbed that ladder. Jason today would have spoke up in the morning. You know, Jason today probably wouldn't even know that. He'd walked off that job. So, you know, so for me, it's that understanding of my journey of why I first started speaking and why I speak today. It's completely different.
It's interesting, and Tim, you've given me the perfect segue there to go to Tim, which is to say, obviously, you've been involved with behavioural safety for a long time now, and we're in 2025. Why have we still got an issue around people speaking up? Jason touched on some of it there, but I'm sure we could expand on it further.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, how long have you got, really, Jules? I mean, it'd be, you know, but speaking up isn't the be all and end all, you know. A lot of people would say if you focus on the individual who hurts themselves, you're pointing in the wrong direction because you're missing the context, and it's all about facilitating good behaviour and culture and so on. Speaking up can, of course, break the chain right at the end. But you know, as Jason said, you know, he would have spoken up in the morning and said, I'm not fit for work. No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't have needed to because he would have been fit for work. And so there would have been nothing to say. And, you know, it's a much bigger picture. And why, you know, but to do, you know, other answers to the question, why do people not speak up? Because they don't think people will listen to them, or they think people will respond negatively to them if they do listen to them. That happens a lot. Or because they can't be bothered because they're in a really bad place and they just can't be asked. Or because they haven't got the time. Or because they're in a rush, or because they perceive the benefits of not speaking up and cracking on outweigh the potential risks. You know, I could go on for a while, really. You know, I think it's, if you don't mind me saying so, Jules, I think it's a terrible question.
Okay, good. Okay, no, that's fine, Tim. Yeah.
You know, okay.
So what's a better question?
Oh no! I'm just trying to tease you.
No, that's fine.
I'm picking up on the vibe between you and Langdon, really, and you know, shoot from the lip and all that. A better question is, why are organisations still pointing at individuals and saying, if only you take full care, mind what you're doing, pay attention, speak up when you need to, we wouldn't have any problems here. I think it's why are organisations still pointing at individuals that is the question.
Okay.
I think to that, so we've done a lot of work around the blame cycle, which, I mean, that's perfectly in line with that. When an incident happens, a lot of times organizations blame the worker, and then management awareness suffers, you know, yada, yada, it continues. What are your thoughts around, and this Jason and Tim, around all the research that's being done, the work we're seeing around serious injury fatalities, human org performance, all that, how can we change it? Because even when organizations, even if they don't necessarily blame the singular employee if something happens, it's still that I know where I can deviate. I have to get the job done. So we know how far we can get or how close we can get to that hazardous or that inherently risky situation. So we're being safe, but we're not being too safe, in essence, and incidents are still occurring. What are your thoughts around that? Because it seems like in the States, that's a lot of the challenge we're having. People, they understand serious injuries, but it's kind of, they try to keep it very much out of sight, out of mind.
Do you mind if I take that one, Jace?
No, okay.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's an awful lot of controversy, especially from people who think that looking at mental health is a disgrace when there are still lots of SIFs to be addressed. And I think the honest answer is that it's understanding why SIFs occur. So it's a subset of the previous answer, really, that you know, SIFs will occur where risks are being taken. And when you look at the way organizations manage risk, if you look at somebody who's got really good at it, like Formula One, you know, they've got really good at risk management, top-down and bottom-up approaches that have taken what was 1.2, I think, a year killed for decades, is now one in 32 years, you know, without anybody slowing down at all. They're just much better at applying the basics of a bow-tie approach. How do we predict what's likely to go wrong? How can we minimize the hit when it does? And if people are involved, something's going to happen sooner or later, because people being people, you know, come up with all sorts of weird and wonderful ways of putting themselves at risk. And truly, it's, you know, the answer is, if you could go into an organization and persuade them to do a really good bit of bow tie work and really put a person and people as they actually are, we like risk for a start. One of the big problems, Langdon, I honestly think, is people quite like risk. You know, the classic book says, if you don't believe me, go to a playground, look at four-year-olds. You know, if the apparatus is too safe, they don't climb through it, they'll climb over it and have a great time doing that. We're born with a risk appetite. Organizations that say, well, we communicated the risk to you. You know, we told you clearly that was risky. You said you knew it was risky. Now look what you've done. I think that's real. That's not even first base. You know, you need to step into the shoes of a person and understand what they might well do, especially on a busy day, or especially if they're having a bad day, and put in some leeway and some solutions either side of it. I think a lot of organizations are pretty crap, frankly.
I always think about this when you think about mental health. Inherently, the thing is linked to unsafe activities, isn't it? Because if you think about the way people are distracted, if you've got lots going on in your life, anyone who's been through any kind of mental health crisis knows that your focus isn't entirely on what you're trying to do in that day or in that moment, is it? You've got other things going on in your head.
You know, it's very controversial. People say, oh, you can't prove the link and so on. There's lots of studies that say people low in situational awareness are risky. People who are fatalistic, Heinrich's principle about the luck you get, and so, you know, deserving the luck you get, tend to be risky. People having bad quality conversations, make bad quality decisions, tend to be risky. I mean, the very essence of safety differently, which kind of overlaps with where we are here, and, you know, is that it's all about the quality of dialogue. You know, what do you need from me to be safe and productive? And those three areas, the research, I think, is really clear. Those three link. You know, and people having a really bad day tend to be high on those three. Over to Jace.
Yeah, like I say to him, I think I'm the classic case study. You know, even today, there are a lot of people, very well thought of safe professionals, who've got a problem with this because there's no proof or they can't. For me, mine was twofold. A, you could say, I was such in a bad place, I just couldn't be bothered. And the second one is, when you're in such a bad place, you come blind to the risk as well. You don't even see the risks. So there's a chance you're so blinkered because you're in such a bad, having a bad day, you're so blinkered, you might not even spot someone else working. And if you spot someone else working, there's a high chance you'll say, oh, let go with it. It's not my problem. We've coined a phrase, you know, over the last 8 years, it's got a little bit of legs to it now. I call it the ethic moment. You know, it stands for what it stands for. But it's what I said in my head just before I did what I did. It was like the effing moment. I know it's unsafe. I know I shouldn't be doing it. So I did all the things I was supposed to do. I stopped. I thought about it. Gave myself for 5 seconds. And then I realised the task that I was being asked to do was unsafe. And I still did it. Now, and when I talk about the effing moment, you know, what goes in your head, I just ask people in the audience, just think back to when you did something unsafe, took a risk, either at work, driving your car, booting for a red light, or that extra pint in the pub where you know you should be home. Your mate says, do you want another pint? You know, should be going out, F it, I'll have one more. I often say, what good action came after that when it goes off in your head? If you ignore it, what good action do you do? And people don't. So people are admitting to me every time I do a presentation that they've said them words in their head And what they've done next, it was unsafe, and they got away with it. And it goes back to a point I hear all the time. We've sent people home safe. We can prove we're sending people home. Look at our stats, our KPIs. We can prove. But I always say, are you sending people home safe, or are you sending people home lucky? Because if you're sending people home lucky, the only thing that you all know about luck, eventually, the luck runs out. You know, I'll be called into a construction site. Oh, we've had two or three work-out incidents over the last year. We can't believe it. Come in. So I do a series of presentations. This was in the old days when I used to start like a real silver bullet. 3 years later, we're going back up. So, oh, we've had a load of incidents again. Can you come back and do another talk? Without actually realising, for the 3 years I've been and gone, nothing's really changed. They just got away with it. But they only see the near miss. So for me, the measure of the effort score is key. And that, you know, well, Tim will expand further, because you get a lot of people like me with high effort score. What does it turn into, Tim?
Yeah, you know, and you know, we talk about the difference between an individual talking, you know, having an high effort score, which is exactly what Jason said. You know, if you're talking about a culture, you know, I don't know if you remember the old Lee Trevino quote, you know, you can talk to a fade, but a hook don't listen. You know, because what you don't want is a high FU score. You know, the classic study, I think, just illustrates really quickly what I mean by this. Take $100, it's an American university, split between two students. First student gets a chance to make an offer to the second student of how they split it. But the rules are they get one offer, they either take it or they decline it, and that's it. So a lot of students said, well, we'll split it 50-50. And they went down the bar and got drunk together probably and had a great time. Some kind of went 60-40. Some went 70-30. Well, different bars, probably. Yeah. But when it got to 80-20, something really interesting happened, because at 80-20, people started saying no. And the person who made the offer would say, what are you doing? What are you mad? You've just turned down $20 for free. And the person would say, no, I didn't turn down $20. I just spent $20 for the unutterable joy of telling you, you're miserable. Do one. You know? And if you understand that mindset, you kind of understand what the FU score is, which is where if we treat people badly enough for long enough, they can get into a really bad place. And enough of them, and then you've got a toxic culture. Then you've got a real problem. Because, you know, if you can talk to somebody with a high FI score, you know, you're all right. What's the problem? Do you want to come and talk to me? Can I help? You can't talk to somebody with a high FU score. You all right? Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah. You want to talk to me? No, I don't. You know, so when we're talking about culture at a real down and dirty level, this is what we're talking about. And there's lots of things that organizations do or don't do that impact on those two scores on a daily basis.
What are the sort of the practical things leadership can be thinking about to affect the FU score? Because that's a really interesting piece for me, Tim, is leadership so often, even the unconscious things they do affect that score negatively, don't they? Because they're not thinking. So it's what are some of the key things that people should be thinking about?
Well, lots and lots. I mean, you know, at an individual level, if you have somebody with a high need for autonomy, they kind of need to be self-employed or they're stressed to hell. You take somebody with a really low need for autonomy and give them that level of autonomy, they'd never sleep. You know? But on a more, so it's about individual differences and preferences and people who want to develop their skills, who haven't got the opportunity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, a couple of simple examples. You're at an airport and a tannoy goes off and says, your flight's delayed, sit there and shut up. You know, it doesn't take you very long to get really quite fed up. You know, you need information. You don't want to be treated like a hamster on a wheel. Or, you know, a classic one to try and tie some basics of culture together. Somebody says to you, I want this job doing safely, but by Friday. We all know that means by Friday, just like, you know, you're a nice bloke, but get your coat, you know, you're going home alone. You know, and so what happens is, of course, we're triggered, often quite subconsciously, to give people the job done by Friday as safely as is viable. And then something goes wrong. And we all end up in court. And the worker and the supervisor, sorry, says, well, I said safely. I've really explicitly said safely. Don't know what's gone wrong with this. And the worker will say, well, you kind of did. But, you know, unless you've got a film of the incident, it's all over to the lawyers. That person then gets blamed, and their colleagues stand around and they've seen this, and that can pump up your FU score, you know, with that little chain of events, because it's you know, the worst thing in the world is to be treated unfairly. Laws are just a kind of often clumsy and biased by the people who wrote them attempt to make us behave fairly to each other. We judge others much more harshly for being unfair than we do for being illegal. So, you know, if people feel they're being treated unfairly, you've got lots of fuel on the flames there.
It's a challenge, right? Even when it seems that, you know, we see a lot with organizations, even when things seem to be going well, to that point you both brought up with the high FU score, it's easy to then still, you do the job, maybe it's one of those, you seemingly everything has been well, even the environment, but what happens outside of work maybe just gave you a bad day. And then you do think about, I've done this job 150 times. I know where the risks are. I know I'm probably going to be fine. So I do it anyway. And then crap happens. And it seems like that's some of the biggest challenges that we see that we discuss a lot, because year over year, we see a lot of the same incidents. People put that focus on the same incidents. Organizations are always, oh, slip, trip and fall is okay. But they rarely ever look at the outliers and then kind of think, after something catastrophic happens, after something serious, to what Jason was talking about earlier, and then were they lucky, or at the end of it, were they just actually pretty good at their job that nothing happened? And that's some of the biggest challenges that we see. And it's kind of thoughts on, I don't know how you overcome that a lot of times.
I think also another big problem is a lot of the studies and stats that people are using are from like late 80s, early 2000, when social media wasn't as much an influence as it is now. You know, so historically, you could have a guy who's having a pretty bad time at home, gets the van in the morning, he's a bit grumpy, but by first break, he's feeling like his problems at home, he's concentrating on his work. And he goes home from work when his problems are at home. Whereas now, with the mobile phones, etc., people are coming to work, and that argument's continuing all day long, they've got phones in their hands, they're not focused on the work, they've been distracted, and vice versa, when they go home, work's contacting them at home as well. So there's no work and home life anymore. For me, it just rolls into one. You know, you say it, don't you? How many times you go on holidays? I'm definitely not checking LinkedIn. The next thing you're on LinkedIn, you're on your holidays. So work never leaves you like it did before. You know, and then also, you know, people talk about mental health, you know, mental health awareness. We used to do that naturally in the 80s and 70s and 80s, where you get in the work van, your mate wasn't speaking to you, and you say, what sort of you then? And he checks, you know, the distraction, where now people can get in the van, they can put their heads down, you know, you go to canteens today, but it's silence. People are just glued to their phones. What an easy way to distract someone from asking you, are you okay, by hiding away, looking at your phone, avoiding contact with people. So I think there's things we did naturally, you know. I'm not as old as the 70s, I spoke to my dad at length, you know, the banter you used to have getting in the vans and digging away from home. They all used to be like a family, and everyone knows everyone's, where today people are so, you know, you're visible, but you're not there half the time. And I think that's another big thing around the mental health thing. It's different. People can't just say it's the same. It's not the same. It's different today.
It's the ultimate irony, isn't it? Sorry, Tim, I'm jumping over you there, that we've created these tools to communicate with, and actually they've destroyed communication, haven't they?
You know, I mean, we've got COVID and long COVID as well. But, you know, if you look at the figures for, you know, there's a program on Netflix at the moment called Adolescence, which everybody's raving about as terrifying, you know, really articulating what's gone wrong with it. Because, you know, all the figures are going in the wrong direction. No, I mean, it was already a huge problem that we kind of ignored. You know, in the UK, for every person we kill in an industrial accident, 32 working age people take their own lives. And it's always been like that, although the accident figures have come down, so the ratio has come down, but it's always been the suicide figures. And you know, and the young generation are getting worse. You know, the smartphone generation, as Jason has just articulated, and the COVID and the school issues about, you know, losing a couple of years, everything, self-harm, suicide, mental health, the stuff that you can't say is snowflake stuff, self-reporting, overdiagnosis, the actual stuff, you know, is going through the roof. And there isn't a country in the world that has got the money and the will to deal with it. Some people have got the will, but not the money, and so on. But we're going to have to deal with this ourselves. It's going to get worse. The new generation coming through are even worse than us lot. You know, people of my age are bad enough. So what are organisations going to do? Because it's a huge risk factor. And about profit and operational excellence, not just about mental health and accidents. And we're going to have to address it ourselves. And we know from the world of safety that to do it well, you need to be proactive. You need to be holistic. You need to be humanistic, you know, and so on. And people are just beginning to get their heads around it as an operational necessity, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it, that for so long we've talked about health and safety, but actually what we really talk about is safety, isn't it? We don't talk about health. It's kind of the little bit to the side that we occasionally touch on if we have to. But I mean, I know when we were talking, sort of getting ready for this, Tim, you talked about the suicide numbers. And again, that's absolutely scary, isn't it, that 32 to 1, we're losing so many people through suicide. And again, there's no doubt that work will be having some kind of influence and effect on those numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the great things is that good work is good for you. You know, you are mentally healthy having a job that you really enjoy. And, you know, you're mentally healthy having a job that you really enjoy than not needing to work at all. It gives you traction. It gives you, as Jay said, it used to give you banter and teamwork and so on, less so, which as Jason said, doesn't help at all. But, you know, the UK military would be a really good example here. People who like being in the army love being in the army. It's a really difficult, dangerous job, but they love it. You know, people hate being ex-soldiers. The suicide figures for ex-soldiers are terrible. You know, and so what we can do as organisations is try and identify what good works looks like and give people good work. It keeps them upright and sane naturally. It gives them purpose and meaning, banter, social interaction, and so on.
I was watching. There's another fascinating program. I'm trying to remember. I was just racking my brains, Tim, trying to remember whether it was on Channel 4 or Channel 5. But they did an experiment at this school in Essex where they didn't just ban mobile phones in school time. They took them off the kids full stop for 21 days. And it was fascinating watching this kind of transformation. At first, he had all these kids kicking off big style. I want to play my games, and I want to text my mates, and I want to do all this. But then what you actually saw was children turning into children again, where they go around and knock on the mate's door and go and play outside. Do that stuff that's good for you.
I remember the program. I didn't watch it because I didn't watch Channel 5, of course. Yeah. Now I'm all posh and professional and everything. But I did hear a review of the program on Radio 4.
Yeah. So. But it was fascinating. But the scariest thing was actually some of the parents sort of pretending to be a 13-year-old child and getting a new phone to see what would happen when they logged on to certain platforms. And very quickly, when they were logging onto things like TikTok, it was taking them down some really, really dark roads that you wouldn't want your children going anywhere near. And you talk about things like suicide, that's a theme that kids are finding on social media. So there's a big question mark, isn't there? I don't know how on earth we put the genie back in the bottle. But smartphones, we say they're not good for kids. They're not good for adults either sometimes, are they?
Been a great conversation with Tim and Jason. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, please be sure to come back and find part two and listen to what else that they've got to say.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. Don't forget to follow and subscribe wherever you stream your podcast, or you can visit us at evotix.com.
And if you've liked today's podcast or you've found some value from it, we'd really appreciate it if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review or a rating. It really means a lot to us. Thank you.